Thursday, May 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, billionaire Donald Trump is now the presumed Republican nominee for the U.S. presidency. We'll talk with a political analyst. Philippine voters will cast ballots in national elections on Monday.
It's a very interesting time right now in Manila, the rest of the Philippines, and everybody is excited about what's going to happen.
And we hear about the movement in the U.S. to convert some golf courses back to nature. It's all ahead. Billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump is now the presumptive Republican nominee for the U.S. presidency. However, early indications are he faces a daunting contest against the likely Democratic candidate, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Numerous national election surveys show Clinton defeating Trump, who surged to the top of a large field of Republican candidates with tough talk to halt illegal immigration into the country from Mexico and temporarily block Muslims from entering the country. Polls give Clinton, the country's top diplomat from 2009 to 2013, about a 6 percentage point edge over Trump, a one-time television reality show host who's never held elective office. A new CNN ORC poll Wednesday showed a bigger Clinton margin, 54 to 41%. Texas Senator Ted Cruz dropped out of the Republican presidential race Tuesday night, and Ohio Governor John Kasich announced his departure Wednesday. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders continues to campaign for the Democratic nomination. Larry Sabato, a political science professor at the University of Virginia, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the country is left with two very controversial candidates for the White House.
Donald Trump is a very controversial candidate, and I'm not sure that many Republicans will ever accept him, but he is the Republican nominee for president. And, of course, on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton managed to lose the Indiana primary rather handily to Bernie Sanders, but she is, of course, the Democratic nominee for president. So I think the general election really begins in May, and even though other candidates may continue to campaign in primaries, everybody's attention is going to turn to November.
The Republican National Committee Chairman, Mr. Priebus, called on a tweet for there to be unity and a focus on defeating Mrs. Clinton. Is that going to be possible?
No, it is not. There are candidates who ran against Trump who will never support him. How could Ted Cruz support Donald Trump after the press conference he gave? If he tried, he would be run out of town as a hypocrite. It is impossible to reunite the Republican Party. There will be very senior elected officials, senators, House members, governors, who will do everything they can do to pretend there is no Republican nominee for president.
What did you make of the Cruz announcement of suspending his campaign? Were you surprised?
Not at all. His campaign was over, whether he admitted it or not.
Mr. Cruz did not endorse Mr. Trump.
It will be amazing if Cruz ever endorses him. And if he does endorse him, there is no one, probably in his immediate family, who will believe it.
What is Mr. Trump's possible path to victory in November?
His path to victory is the fact that Hillary Clinton is almost as disliked as much as he is. His path to victory would be if President Obama's approval rating declined significantly, if there is, God forbid, a terrorist attack that the administration does not respond well to, or if there is an economic recession or depression.
Months ago, when this process began, did you foresee a possible Trump-Clinton matchup?
My new definition of a liar is anyone who claims to have said that Donald Trump would be the Republican nominee last summer.
Larry Sabato says the presidential candidates emerging from this year's contest say more about the selection process than it does about the American voter. He says there are too few people taking part in the nominating process and says the system is broken and in need of repair. He says better people must be able to run for office and the voter needs to have better choices. A Among the world's top stories, European Union proposals regarding migrants draw criticism. Russian artillery is engaged in the Syrian city of Aleppo as dozens are killed during a rebel assault. The U.S. and its allies discuss the next steps in their fight against the Islamic State, and President Barack Obama drinks filtered water in Flint, Michigan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. This is VOA's International Edition.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your peek, watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA. Philippine voters are preparing to cast ballots in the presidential election taking place on Monday. The mayor of Davao City, Rodrigo Duterte, leads his closest challengers, Senator Grace Poe and Mar Roxas, the candidate backed by the current president, Benigno Aquino III. I spoke with blogger and Manila Bulletin columnist Tonio Cruz about the election, beginning with Mr. Duterte's candidacy.
Mayor Rodrigo Duterte heads the Philippines' biggest city in terms of size of land area. He has been quite popular. He has served in the local government for close to 30 years. He was a vice mayor of that city, of Davao, in 1987, after the EBSA People Power Uprising. He was appointed vice mayor of Davao, and then later on he became mayor. So he has been the mayor for a very long time. And he is also well-known. The big island of Mindanao, south of the Philippines, really wants to have one of its own sons to be the president of the country. It's a legitimate dream of the people of Mindanao. At the same time, there are many mounting anger of the public over issues against the outgoing administration. So Mayor Duterte is sweeping what he could call a protest vote. That's why he's leading in the polls, in the final polls released by at least two outfits.
Yes, I've heard him referred to as the sort of Donald Trump of the Philippines, in a way.
It's not really accurate. It's quite unfair to Mayor Duterte. Duterte has very long executive experience in government. Donald Trump is none. Mayor Duterte is not rich. Donald Trump is a billionaire. There are many differences, and I think it is not that accurate. This is, I think, part of the propaganda of the palace and of the administration to demonize Mayor Duterte.
Well, another person who's fairly high up in the polls is Senator Grace Poe. She's also lived in the United States, and I believe her late father was a well-known actor in the Philippines.
Yes, Senator Grace Poe, according to the polls, is Mayor Duterte's closest rival for the presidency. She is presenting a reform-oriented program that directly addresses the many concerns about the Aquino administration. Senator Poe used to be a naturalized U.S. citizen, but she has since reclaimed her Philippine citizenship. She has succeeded with the case before the Supreme Court of the Philippines, and the court has allowed her to run. And the court has said she's fully qualified to run for president. According to the poll of the Manila Standard that was released just today, Mayor Duterte leads Senator Poe by around 5 points, 32 points to 25 points. The margin of error is around 1.8%. It's a very interesting time right now in Manila and the rest of the Philippines, and everybody is excited about what's going to happen. People are wondering what the government might do because the administration candidate, former Secretary Mar Roas, is also at second place. Senator Poe and Secretary Roas are in a statistical tie. Senator Poe at 25 and Secretary Roas at 22. But there are fears that the government may use the machinery and resources of the public to push Mar Roas way past Duterte. And it has happened before. I mean, people are quite concerned that it may happen again. So all of the parties are raising concerns, and even the poll watchdogs are telling the public to be watchful and to be vigilant on election day.
Blogger and columnist for the Manila Bulletin, Tonio Cruz. Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the son of the late dictator, is among the candidates competing for the vice presidency of the Philippines. Nigeria and its neighboring allies have been waging a military offensive against Boko Haram insurgents. But while efforts have succeeded in reducing major attacks, the group remains a threat, often using women and children in suicide bomb attacks. The International Crisis Group says it will take more than military action to defeat the group. VOA's Jota Kapua reports.
Tens of thousands of people have died in Boko Haram attacks since 2009. Millions have been displaced. Hundreds of girls have been abducted, some forced into child marriages, others strapped with explosives and sent into crowded markets. Local economies and cross-border trade have been damaged or disrupted by the insurgency. The ICG has released a new report called Boko Haram on the Back Foot. The report's been released prior to a regional security summit in Abuja, Nigeria. In Dakar, Dr. Vincent Fouché is a senior analyst for the International Crisis Group. He assesses the current strength of Boko Haram in the wake of the regional military response.
It's difficult to put a precise number for the fighters because it's a movement that can kind of morph back into the countryside in case it needs to do so. But, you know, it's still there. It's certainly on the back foot. It has lost quite a lot of ground since last year. It is now mostly operating in the northeastern quadrant of Borno State, which is the most northeastern state in Nigeria. And it can operate some actions in neighboring Cameroon as well, in the far north of Cameroon. But its reach has really diminished.
He warns against declaring mission accomplished in efforts to defeat the group.
We think that it doesn't mean that it's not there anymore. It still is a challenge. It can transform. It can redeploy. It can turn into a full terrorist organization.
Fouché says while counterinsurgency action is still needed, there must be a broader view of the Boko Haram problem.
I think it's quite important to realize that it's actually a mixed bag of people who are there for a variety of reasons. A number of people are there because of local struggles, because of economic opportunities, because they were looking for protections as well in a situation of civil war. And I think it's quite important that we allow some doors to remain open for people to speak and engage. Full eradication of an insurgency this size is just not reasonable. It's just not feasible. There remains a need to be open to discussion.
The International Crisis Group senior analyst says there's a major humanitarian issue that must be addressed as well.
There's a very substantial population of IDPs and refugees. We're talking about almost 3 million people. Those people live in extremely difficult conditions because the camps and the resources for the camps are not there. A lot of them actually do not live in camps. Those camps are not sustainable. So something needs to be done, otherwise part of this population could become vulnerable to recruitment in the insurgency as well.
He also says there's the long-term challenge of economic inequality in the Lake Chad Basin. It's been made worse by the Boko Haram insurgency. Militant groups often find recruits among poor populations who feel they've been neglected by their governments. Fouché praises the joint military efforts by Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger.
It's particularly notable, actually, between Nigeria and Cameroon. Remember that those two countries were almost at war 20 years ago on the southern border. Now those two countries are really making interesting steps towards cooperation. That's a very, very positive thing. One country's problems are also another country's problems. You just can't stand by and watch.
The Regional Security Summit in Abuja is scheduled for May 14th. The four nations' international partners will also attend. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Turning to our social media segment, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio with what's happening online. Hi, G.
Hi, Sarah.
It's yet another day of Donald Trump making the headlines.
It is.
What's the buzz online?
The buzz today is from Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. She's not a stranger to criticizing Trump, but this time she really stepped up her game. She said he built his campaign on racism, sexism, and xenophobia.
I see. How influential is her message on social media?
Very influential. She has more than 2 million likes on Facebook and almost a million followers when you combine her two verified accounts on Twitter. The handles are @Elizabeth4MA and @SENWarren. You will find more information about her thoughts on the presidential race @Elizabeth4MA. Her full statement on Trump is on her Facebook page, and this is the gist of it. She argued he incites violence among his supporters and attacks veterans like John McCain. She ended the statement with, "I am going to fight my heart out to make sure Donald Trump's toxic stew of hatred and insecurity never reaches the White House."
What's the public's reaction like to that post?
When I sorted the comments by popularity, the top 10 replies were urging her to endorse Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders as a Democratic nominee.
Okay, what else is trending?
French fashion house Chanel held a runway show in Cuba's capital, Havana. Many people commented, "It's sad how the majority of Cubans don't know very much about the brand and probably will never own anything by the designer." But some people did point out that the attention it's bringing to Cuba will be good for the country's tourism industry. Sarah, back to you.
Well, thanks, G, for the wrap-up. That's our own social media guru, G. Abby Lee. Please tweet your questions and comments to @VOA_IE. You can also tag me and G on the tweets. We are @VOA Williams and @G Abby Lee. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Back in late September 2015, NASA excited the science community when they confirmed evidence of liquid water flowing on present-day Mars. Now, a new French-based study suggests that not only does liquid water exist on Mars, but it boils quite violently as soon as it reaches the surface. Water at sea level here on Earth boils at 100 degrees Celsius, but atmospheric pressure also affects water's boiling point. Since the atmosphere of Mars is so thin, it has only 0.6% of Earth's mean sea level air pressure, which means that water on Mars can boil at a temperature as low as 0 degrees Celsius. And according to the scientists, the fiercely boiling water also creates an explosive flow that can blast dirt, dust, and other sediment off the ground, in a process that could make significant changes to the Martian landscape. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. Depressed oil prices have dampened hydrocarbon exploration and development activity worldwide. Oil companies in the service industry that supports exploration and production have laid off tens of thousands of workers in recent months, so it came as no surprise that attendance was down this year at the annual Offshore Technology Conference in Houston. But as VOA's Greg Flakes reports from the Texas city, a lot of oil services companies are there anyway, focusing on ongoing industry needs as well as an eventual recovery.
Virtual reality comes to the oil fields in this training device created by the Chinese Huanghua Group. But there may not be a big market for this right now. Huanghua's Milo Liu says low oil prices have reduced exploration activity almost everywhere.
The only area that we still have something going on, that's probably Middle East. Now everywhere else, it's pretty dead.
So why set up a large display at this year's offshore technology conference?
You just have to show your face. You still got to let them people know that you're still here.
Though attendance is down from previous conferences, service companies are here offering everything from large ships and exploration platforms to small devices that measure flow through pipes. Richard Knott of London-based Lloyd's Register Energy says those shutting down projects now will eventually need his company's assistance.
Many of these projects that have been cancelled or deferred are actually, they've not gone away. They've gone away for a rethink as to how we can do this more cheaply, how we can maybe do it quicker, how we can maybe do it more effectively.
Lloyd's Brady Austin, who works at the company's Houston office, says developing an offshore project is an expensive long-term investment.
It takes years to get all of that in place because there's a lot of decisions that have to be made. And in a market like this, you have to critique each one even more.
At 3M Corporation's booth, Steve Kosh demonstrated a safety harness and escape system for companies that put workers on tall derricks.
You still have employees working for you. They're going to be out working at heights, and so you have to protect those workers. Now, obviously, we're trying to find solutions for the employers to try to find low-cost solutions to their needs.
Although there's been some recovery in oil prices recently, most people attending this conference say they're prepared for a downturn that could last into next year and beyond. Greg Flakus, VOA News, Houston.
There's a growing need here in the United States to let old or underused golf courses revert back to nature. But as Erica Celeste reports from one parcel in Grafton, Ohio, converting 39 hectares of land back to green space is a lot more complicated than just not mowing the fairway.
In the game of golf, a mulligan is slang for a second chance. Not long ago, Royal Oaks Golf Club got a major mulligan of its own when the underused property was turned into a nature preserve. Cart paths were converted to walking trails. Water hazards became fishing ponds. That's finally given Jerry Jewell a chance to enjoy the green space.
I lived there before when it was a golf course, but actually never came back here and played golf on it, you know. So I really never got a chance to see what it looked like as far as, you know, the landscape and stuff.
Jewel's story is something that Joe Leslie with Western Reserve Land Conservancy has heard many times.
There's a select number of people that would use a golf course where, in the case of a passive or an active recreation area for that matter, it gives the opportunity for many more people to use it.
Western Reserve has worked on 10 similar projects in Ohio, and golf courses across the country are being returned to the wild. A recovering real estate market, the declining popularity of golf, and clubhouses and restrooms that already exist on the land are a few of the reasons for the trend. However, Leslie notes, conservation projects come with costs.
Because the conversion to a golf course has stripped away some of those natural resource attributes that would allow us to get funding, some of our public funding.
Often the land must be surveyed to decide how best to restore it, followed by excavation of sand and gravels used in many golf courses. Then fairway grasses must be replaced with native plants and native species must be reintroduced. Finally, it's not uncommon to have issues with the pesticides and fertilizers that were used to keep the green green. But the economic and ecological benefits of these projects outweigh the costs, says Jim Zemnick, director of the county parks, which partnered with Western Reserve on the conservation. For the Royal Oaks property, he points to improved flood prevention.
We also know historically that this actually used to have a lot of wetlands, the soil types. So eventually we're looking then to help develop some wetlands.
Returning the golf course to its natural state will allow it to filter heavy snowmelt or rain back into the nearby Black River instead of into the basements of surrounding homes and businesses as it has for years. Zimnick says the key with projects like this is to be patient. Even though the park is now open, there's still plenty to do.
It's probably going to be, in terms of trails, decks, overlooks, wetlands, it's probably going to be the better part of 10 years.
As for Jerry Jewell, who now uses the park every day, he doesn't mind waiting. With what he's seen so far, he believes things will only get better. For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in Grafton, Ohio.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition here on The Voice of America. Stay tuned for the latest world news coming up next. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair Al-Tayeb, I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Although the fight for political freedom is a universal challenge, three African nations, Burundi, Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Republic of Congo, experienced a significant increase in human rights abuses related to their elections in 2015. Burundi's human rights climate took a turn for the worse in April 2015 when the ruling political party, the National Council for the Defense of Democracy, Forces for the Defense of Democracy, announced that the incumbent president, Pierre Nkurunziza, would run for a third term, which he won in July 2015, in violation of the Arusha Agreement. Human rights monitors have documented at least 474 individuals killed since April 2015, including 130 targeted assassinations. Other serious human rights abuses linked to the political crisis include extrajudicial killings, arbitrary and politicized detention, often in inhuman and life-threatening conditions, and widespread government disregard for the freedoms of speech, press and media, assembly and association, and sexual and gender-based violence. In the Republic of the Congo on October 25th, the ruling Congolese Labor Party and its allies won a landslide victory in a referendum to amend the constitution to allow President Denis Sassou Nguesso to run for a third term. 35 civilians were reported killed during demonstrations leading up to the referendum, and voters faced intimidation and severe restrictions on basic freedoms. In January 2015, political tensions intensified in the Democratic Republic of Congo when protests erupted in Kinshasa, Goma, and Bukavu over a push by President Joseph Kabila's presidential majority for electoral legislation mandating a nationwide census that would have delayed presidential elections past 2016. The United Nations Joint Human Rights Office confirmed 10 deaths, while Human Rights Watch reported 38 civilian deaths, 5 disappearances, and more than 300 arrests during the protests. Additionally, there were numerous reports of opposition members arrested in cities across the country. Abuses have continued to increase. The UN has stated that it has documented more than 400 cases of human rights violations, including 52 arrests since the beginning of 2016. In all three cases, the United States has expressed concerns for these trends both publicly and privately. Universally, it is the primary responsibility of the state to address human rights abuses through accountability and prevention. This is a challenge all over the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is for, what's